Okay, here we go.
Welcome, welcome, ladies and gents. Mike Ensign is back in the house. So, yeah, just we're continuing another trend, just some inspirational music bands.
Yeah, probably my 10 favorite artists after all the years of listening to music for 50-plus years. So, and I was thinking earlier, everyone's got a different list of their 10 favorite artists. It'd be really strange.
You don't know how much of it is, you know, the record company is jotting to be on that list versus they actually legit love those guys growing up and no one can tell them otherwise because nostalgia, it's so powerful.
Yeah. So these are just artists I go back to all the time. So, and then I'm doing the four favorite albums, or not necessarily favorite, four albums that represent them. And then maybe a couple of those might be, oh, this is kind of an underrated album, but you got to hear this, and this is why. So that's what we set it up as. So anyway, I get started on Otis Redding.
Yeah, let's do it.
Live in Europe is an amazing live album. It's 67. He died in 67, the end of the year with a plane crash. But Live in Europe, and it's been repackaged with more songs and stuff, but the original Live in Europe that came out back then is just one of these records where the sound is terrific. The audience interaction is terrific. He goes through 10 songs of his catalog and improves every one of them. I think he outdoes the Rolling Stones on Satisfaction on this. That's how good a live performance it is. He also does Day Tripping by the Beatles. And there's a great moment where Otis says, I want to sing a ballad song, something what we call So. And someone in the audience goes, yeah! Wait, and he starts laughing. It's just the interaction with the performer and the audience in this record is amazing. It's really worth picking up. It should be easy to find. Otis Redding Live in Europe. So that's a good one to kick off.
Live in Europe. They done.
Yeah. Yeah. And then probably his best studio album is Otis Blue. Full title is Otis Blue / Otis Redding Sings Soul, and it's got a white blonde woman on the cover. That's how they marketed records back then, soul records, you know, a lot of times. But that's got Old Man Trouble, Change Is Gonna Come. He covers the Sam Cooke classic, I've Been Loving You Too Long, My Girl, Wonderful. Yeah, a lot of that stuff is on Live in Europe, but this is the studio version. In fact, Satisfaction's on there too. So that's, if you're going to pick one Otis studio album, that's the one to get. And another great live album is Live at the Whiskey a Go-Go from Otis Redding.
Live at the Whiskey Go-Go, okay.
Yeah, it's in L.A. I've been in that building once. I was in L.A. in 85, and I wandered around Sunset Strip. And then at that time, the Whiskey Go-Go was used for a Springsteen. It was called the Boss Club on Tuesday nights. They play Springsteen videos, and that's when, you know, Springsteen was almost bigger than Coca-Cola in 1985. So, but it was the same building. Whiskey Go-Go, of course, is famous for the Doors being the house band for a while, and pretty historic place. But that's another live album where it's you can just feel the audience interaction. It's almost like you can taste the sweat on that one.
But just that visual and interactive.
Yeah, it's a audio record, but it feels like you're in the house. So it's pretty amazing that those two live albums from him, the sound quality was that good even back, you know, back in the late 60s. And then there's also a box set called the Definitive Otis Redding, which just goes through tracks from his albums, rare stuff, rare B-sides, and if you're going to get one Otis Redding thing, that'd be the one to pick up, the Definitive Box. But Otis Redding, his astounds me. I think he died. He's not, I don't think he's in the 27 club. I think he died when he was 28. But he has this authority on stage. He sounds like a guy in his 40s. Mm-hmm. He commands the stage. Yeah. Okay. 1941 to 1967. Do the math here. 26 Yeah, he might have been only 26 when he died.
That's terrible.
Age 26. And I just, it always astounds me. I realize he's only 26 years old. He has, like I said, he's got the authority of a 40-year-old man, you know, and like he'd been doing it for 40 years performing live. So, and that voice has influenced tons of singers since. I remember a Rolling Stone record guide, they'd listed, I think every one of his albums had 5 stars, you know, back when that came out in the 80s.
Right.
But, yeah, and I'm still waiting for the movie. It might be too tough to do a movie on him. If you want to see a movie of Otis Redding, watch Monterey Pop, and there's 2 or 3 songs that he does at Monterey, the Monterey Pop Festival.
It was wild how in this, like, first giant 5 decades of film, how it was pretty easy for them to just kind of just get a bunch of variety show people and music people in every other film. And
yeah,
it seemed like only other kids movies seemed to kind of follow that trend for a while and then got back on it.
Yeah. The Tammy Show is another early rock film that has, I mean, the Rolling Stones are in it. James Brown's in it. Jan and Dean host it. It's an amazing one to look up to. Anyway, so yeah, Otis Redding, Kind of Blue, Live in Europe, Whiskey a Go Go, and the definitive box set if he wants to pick up. And I mentioned the Rolling Stones a minute ago. I didn't like the Stones for a long time because I saw them in '81. At the Pontiac Silverdome, which is a terrible place to see a concert. It's no longer there. It was where the Detroit Lions played back in the day. And it's just a huge barn. And it's just this, I don't know, 150,000 seats or whatever it was.
And sweet.
This big echo chamber. And what ticked me off is Iggy Pop opened for him. He got booed off the stage, which was sad because he's from Detroit.
Was he just not killing it all that well, or was he just...
I don't think a lot of the crowd knew who he was, sadly. Even though he's from Detroit area, I think they were there to see the Stones, and that was it. And then Santana came out, and they played really well. But then I think Mick and Keith had some argument going because after Santana, they didn't come out for 2 hours.
Oh, that's garbage.
We all just sat there. I remember looking at, we had seats up on one of the right, you know, on the side up high. And I remember looking at the crowd on the main floor and seeing all this brown, it was in wintertime, seeing all this brown hair down there. I said, it looks like a big pile of shit down there. It was awful, you know, And I think somebody threw up on somebody in front of me, and so I didn't like the Stones for many years after that. We left her in satisfaction because we were just finally, let's go. We've seen it, you know. But we, you know, we stayed for most of it. But
it is hard with concerts for me nowadays, where I'm just like, okay, well, I like this, and it might be worth my money's worth, but you know, I got to get up at a certain time. I can't
be
here all 3 hours.
And I did wind up seeing them years later at Michigan State University. And it was in the summertime. It was an outdoor concert at, you know, where they play football there again, the college team. And that was a much better show. And
you want it to improve too, if it's just the same venue every time.
Yeah. And we also got a wedding present 2 days before we got married. We got to see the Stones in Chicago at Soldier Field. And the only thing wrong with that, it was ice cold. It was in October when it was, you know, Chicago's cold anyway. And it was just chilly. And at one point, Mick Jagger says, I can't feel me feet. So that kind of soured that. Elvis Costello opened for him. And I think he did a solo set. And I don't remember much about that. But I mentioned Elvis Costello before. I'm a fan of his. But anyway, the Stones albums to get. Exile on Main Street, a double album. It's muddy sounding, but it's one of those records, like I think I mentioned last time with Blonde on Blonde. I didn't get it at first, and then all of a sudden I all of a sudden you just, it clicks. Okay, I get it now. You know, you get interested. You read about it, you know, you play it the first time, go, I don't, really?
That's what this is about.
Yeah, but then it kind of stays in your, okay. It's kind of like with Mystery Science Theater 3000, first time I watched it, what is this, you know? But it planted something in your brain. I got it. Okay, I got to check this out again. And all of a sudden, okay, I get it. Yeah, it's got its highs and lows. It's the way the album is structured, each song complements the one before it. And the Exile on Main Street, it's got Tumbling Dice is on there, Happy, Keith's greatest hit. May the Good Lord shine His Light on You. Shine a Light is a song, and Martin Scorsese used that for his movie about the Stones, that title.
Yep.
Darn it, what else? Just go buy it. And to Get Your Ya-Ya's Out is a great live album that's Madison Square Garden, 69, I believe. And I remember my wife's a big Stones fan. I said, you play that record, it sounds like a semi barreling down the highway with like bang, just all that noise and commotion, but sounding great. Not like, you know, it's got that kind of energy,
mm-hmm.
like a runaway train, just, you know, that's a great live record from them. Then Let It Bleed has got, You Can't Always Get What You Want, and the last song, and then it's got, it kicks off with Gimme Shelter, which is still an amazing song. And
catch.
Yeah. Other than the fact that it was used in the movie, Can't Always Get What You Want was, if you've ever seen High Fidelity, the movie, John mm-hmm. Cusack and Jack Black were.
Great movie.
Where somebody says, you can't always get your, oh, but it was used in the movie The Big Chill. And he goes, oh, yeah. You know, you can't.
A fun movie within a movie parody. Yeah.
Oh, that's right. Oh, Dave, Frank Conniff is on record as just hating The Big Chill. And I like to call it The Big Click, you know. And then the junior version was, I think they actually called it The Little Chill when it came out, St. Elmo's Fire. So much of overprivileged, Oh, great. We listen to Motown music, so we're cool. They're dancing in the kitchen to Motown and The Big Chill.
Frank Conniff, for those who don't know, we make a lot of Mystery Science Theater references.
Oh, yeah. TV's Frank.
Yeah. But yeah, it is funny how certain movies and songs were just like, well, we might not like it, but it is what it is. You know, yeah. I'm going to rewatch it just because.
The Big Chill also started this awful trend in movies for decades later of white people bopping to soul music. you can't move that good. Come on, you know.
It's not how it works.
Like with a family where they all got microphones and they're singing, you know. You've seen those scenes, right? I think there's a Bruce Willis movie where that happens with Michelle Pfeiffer. I can't remember the name. This Is Us, I think it was called. Oh, no, that's a TV show.
Yeah, I know what you meant. I think
I think it was The Story of Us. Anyway, don't do that. It doesn't
it's like
George Carlin says, don't wear a baseball cap backwards. You're never going to look as cool. Anyway, then the other one, the other Stones album I like is Sticky Fingers. That might actually
not to be confused with the rapper from Oinks.
With the what?
Not to be confused with the rapper from Oinks.
Oh, I didn't even know there was one called that.
Okay. Yeah, he's an actor now, Sticky Fingers.
Oh, okay. I wonder if he got the title from the Stones album or just did it.
Sure, something.
And that's like if you boiled Exile down to one album, that'd be Sticky Fingers. That's terrific record.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to think what's on there. Oh, there's that one, like almost a jazz rock fusion song on there. I should be more prepared here. Sorry about that. Just a second. And then Wild Horses has been used in movies. Moonlight Mile's an amazing song. Again, these 10 artists of mine, there's very few bad songs, and most of them are just what I like to call transcendent. They just jump off the album. That sounds corny, but you know what I mean.
Yes, I do.
Okay, so we got to move on to Bruce Springsteen, who I've been...
Rocks.
I used to drive people crazy with my Springsteen obsession. I've just got... I was 18.
I'm sorry, guys. He rocks.
Yeah. They're playing the Stones there. I went down on my lunch hour. I just started working at Michigan Bell. I'd been there like just started that year. I went down on my lunch hour in June or July and got seventh row centers tickets to see him at Wings Stadium in Kalamazoo.
Really?
You'd never be able to do that. It didn't even sell. It was like 6,000 seat hall, 6,700 seats, and it sold about 3,000. But seventh row center, I didn't notice that till later. And I was just, I mean, I was so close to where I swear I had Bruce looked at me a few times. You know, and I'd read he focuses on the first 10 rows. Being an 18-year-old kid, I remember at one point during the show, they were between songs, and I was looking up at the ceiling.
Mm-hmm.
And this is kind of cool, Billy. Like, I wasn't bored. I would guess I was, you know, attention span at 18 years old isn't the greatest. And I looked back at the stage, and Bruce was looking right at me, and then he grinned. It's like, pay attention. I'll go to my dying day swearing that happened, you know. But
fun stuff.
And I read later that he does focus on the first 10 rows. So I was within your eye shot there, if that's a word. But yeah, I've seen, I'm 62. I've seen almost that many shows. And starting with the Darkness tour, that was 78. And then the only tour I missed was the Amnesty International tour, which he did with a bunch of other bands. And even that I saw on HBO, one show. I didn't see the last Broadway run, but I saw the one before it. So
nice.
So, but I've seen every tour since, and I've also seen Steve's band once in '83, Miami Steve.
Miami Steve Van Zandt.
And I've seen Nils Lofgren twice in town here. Trying to think who else. Oh, Max's band. He played Meyer Gardens, which is an outdoor place.
I got to hear an interview on how he got the gig on Conan O'Brien a few years ago. And it was wild how it just had he not seen like that 60 Minutes like chat the night before, he would have never recognized him, you know, in Town Square or wherever it was.
Wow. Oh, they didn't recognize him?
Well, you know, Conan wasn't known back then. This is when. He was first launched, you know. Yeah, unless you were working at 30 Rock, you didn't know who the hell he was. He's just like, Saturday Night Live Simpsons writer. So
yeah, I remember tuning that in when it first started, thinking it was terrible, but then I caught up to him later. It's one of those things you had to see once or twice to get it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think he's also said when they first started, they were just trying way too hard or they were a little bit too outrageous. But they got over that quick. So, yeah, Conan was great. Now, was Max his band from the get?
Yeah. He got all these other record guys who were mainly just doing weddings and everything. And it was just one of those, it's like, producers talked to Max saying, we got you. How quick can you get your crew together? Yada, yada, yada.
Yeah.
And let's make it take off. And there's this guy. His name is Jimmy Vivino.
Well, I think he had some of Southside Giant, the Asbury Jukes horn section in that band too.
I believe so. He definitely took people from like five different like just areas of bands who had been playing with numerous people for years, and they're like at the third stage of their career by that point.
Yeah, and it worked out well, you know.
And Max hadn't done anything in a while outside of you know East Street, and so he was looking for some hurt.
Yeah, it worked out well for him because then I think he actually used to. Well, actually, we've seen Bruce in the E Street Band with Max's kid playing drums because Max, I think, had a Conan O'Brien commitment at the time. Or not the whole tour, but he could. We saw him, I think, in Chicago where it was Max's kid playing drums. So it all evened out at the end. they all got back together, and they supposedly were going to tour this year, but COVID's rearing its ugly head yet, so we'll see if that happens. Anyway, so I have met Bruce a few times and joked around. I got a great picture of him on my Facebook page, somewhere in there. Sweet. In my photos. It's him and me laughing in Chicago. And nice. then I met him on his acoustic tour in Detroit a few years later. He signed the back of it. I said, "Can you write something funny on there?" He goes, "Let's see. Hi." So the back of the photo says, "Hi, Bruce Lee." So, and I did meet him in front of the Broadway thing, and I filmed that. And I was at the end of the line on one side, and I said, "Bruce, just want to say thanks." He goes, "Thank you." And then I said, "I've been a fan for 46 years. And he looked right at me and goes, "I appreciate that." So I got that on film. So that's kind of cool.
Nice. Yeah. Interaction, baby.
Yep. So, yeah, Springsteen's my favorite artist of the last, since I was in high school, 76. So, but the four albums, Born to Run is still my favorite Bruce album. That's just, there's something, you never get to the bottom of that record. There's just hidden stuff in there to this day. That I don't know if it's a production or what. It's just, and it's eight songs, and they're all great. The density of that record and the lyrics and the emotion, and it was his make or break record too. He just comes through. And nice. I think he's written better songs, but it's kind of like Sergeant Pepper, as the album is more than the sum of its parts. If you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
And then Darkness after that. That's another one. Born to Run, Darkness and the River, that trilogy he talked about years ago. And Born to Run, it sounded like they were trying to punch through the ceiling of the studio the whole record. And Darkness, it feels like they draw back and just get more intense. And then when The River came out, it sounds like they just explode, and they finally figured things out.
It's definitely an unusual predicament. It's like,
Yeah, and the first four records he did are all, the first one's kind of like a folk, like a Bob Dylan wannabe record in some ways. And the production isn't that great. And The Wild and the Innocent sounds like seven different bands, the second album. There's seven songs. They sound like seven different bands recorded them. Then Born to Run came out, Darkness, then The River. And The River, I don't know what it is. There's some weird finality to that record that it doesn't quite work for me. But I saw they just did the tour a couple years ago where they did the album all the way through again to open the show. Yeah, right. I think it was just I understood the record more after that. I'm gonna go through his whole catalog, but I'm not careful. But the next album for Bruce would be Born in the USA, which a lot of people think is overrated and brought the huge bandwagon in. But to me, it sounds like The River condensed into one album. I mean, some right. of the songs even sound like, and it just. And it's stronger for that. People always talk about the Beatles' White Album if it make a better single album, which I don't think is true. I love every track on that, but that's kind of what he did with Born in the USA. He just kind of some of the same ideas. And of course it, you know, made him bigger than Coca-Cola for that year. That was a huge record. I think it's at one time was the biggest selling record in Columbia Records history.
That's something.
And
did he stay with Sony or did he take off?
No, he's been with Sony or Columbia his whole career.
All right, so, cool. I didn't know. For whatever reason, yeah. I always thought he was a Warner Brothers guy. But,
yeah. And then this is going to be controversial. Working on a Dream came out a few years ago. I don't know if are you familiar with that record at all?
Yeah.
It's got Outlaw. One. Outlaw Pete and Queen of the Supermarket.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people hate it. A lot of friends of mine that were fans hated that record. Like, what he's singing about ponies, you know.
Queen of the Super. Find him pretty. He's kind of critic proof in a way, and at the same time, like,
yeah,
I can't think of anything which would make me, you know, because there's been a few U2 albums which were kind of a little too mushy, and with Springsteen, I can't think of anything that really just stood out as just a sore thumb where you're just like, what were they thinking? It's like, yeah, he pretty much did what he wanted to do. He's still singing. It's pretty much all down to personal taste at that point.
Well, the secret of working on a dream is it's a studio. It's a Sgt. Pepper. You can't really do that album live. In fact, he didn't do it live. He did a couple songs from it, but it's a studio creation. And I don't think you can duplicate that live the way
probably it was. Not.
Yeah. It sounds like of all his records, it sounds most like a Beatles record. And, you know, Beatles, after a while, when they started getting really heavy in the studio, they couldn't really duplicate that stuff live. So that's the cool thing about working on a dream for me.
Mm-hmm.
So, but good grief. You get, ask me next week and it'll be another four records. You know? So, I love the last one he came out with too. I letter to you that's in the car right now. So we're on the phone, spinning in the car on the phone. So we'll see what he does next.
Totally.
Anyway, got to move on to the Who.
The Who.
Yeah. I saw them at the Silver Dome, I think 2 years after this, or a year and a half after the Stones, and it was a much better show. I just remember, even after seeing Springsteen and stuff, I just had this huge grin on my face that whole show with the Who. Just, nice. I think it was just like, oh, we finally got to see these guys. You know, Keith Moon was gone by then, of course. It was Kenny Jones. But and that was their, quote, farewell tour, unquote, in 83. And, of course, they've come back many times since. And then I've seen them.
That what you will, guys.
Yeah. I saw the Who again on the Quadrophenia tour in Detroit. And I've seen them three times in Grand Rapids. They like Grand Rapids for some reason. You know, Van Andel Arena.
It's probably a loyal crowd.
But they're at the stage now where you you go to see the Who, and Roger's going to be ticked off at some point when he gets. Dave Marsh, the rock critic, has said the Who is the band like the one house on the block that everybody knows their domestic problems. You know, everybody, they don't hide anything. The Who just, you know, when they're mad or they're mad about something, and
they just speak to them.
Yeah. But anyway, my
it's
favorite,
hard to even explain to certain people, because they're like, what are you talking about? We're talking about that basically everyone connects with these guys.
Yep. So now it's just Keith and Pete, but the songs are so great. It's cool they have Ringo's kid playing drums too, Zach Starkey. So, and but Keith Moon was, good grief. I wish I could have seen Keith Moon, but he was also a scary guy. There's footage on one of their documentaries where he's high on elephant tranquilizer, I think, at a show, and you could just it's terrifying footage. I think there's a show where they actually got somebody out of the audience to play drums because he was so far out of it, you know. It's just a shame that he just ruined his life like that, you know. But but he was, you know, still one of the most powerful drummers that ever lived. So that's a big tragedy that he died so young. Then there was that, what was it, Cincinnati concert where the kids got trampled? Remember that? Yeah.
I think I heard about it. Yeah.
Yeah, 79. And the Cincinnati Band Festival seating. And I was actually at the first concert in many years after that where they allowed festival seating, and it was Springsteen, because they had festival seating in the front, but it was handled so well. You had to have a wristband to get in, and you got let, you know, it wasn't like a big rush to the stage that happened that night. So they learned some. I don't, you've seen WKRP, and you remember the episode where the about the Who concert tragedy?
I think I've seen part of it. Yeah.
Yeah. It was pretty powerful TV for, you know, a comedy show. So anyway, on the lighter side,
on the lighter side,
my favorite, Who album still is Quadrophenia. I've said this many times. It's a double album, which is kind of, with the age of CD, double album doesn't mean a lot much anymore, but mm-hmm. back in the vinyl days, double, oh, two records, you know.
Two records.
Yeah. So it runs about 80 minutes, but it's the most cohesive album I've ever heard, which is amazing because it's twice as long as the standard albums back then. I think the secret of that is there's so many water sound effects on it, like ocean sounds.
Something throughout like the record. That.
I think that actually connects it, but I think thematically it tells a better story than Tommy, and every song just flows into the next one better than any other record I can think of. So that's on my list. And then Who's Next? You can't leave Who's Next out. I mean, Won't Get Fooled Again and Bob O'Reilly have been played to death, I know, but it's still, they've been played to death for a good reason because they're just great songs. So. And the dynamic, I remember somebody complaining about on Won't Get Fooled Again that synthesizer riff towards the end where it just repeats and repeats. It's building up tension. And all of a sudden, you know, you get the Rogers scream. It's just, you need that. You're just waiting for it. And then Keith comes in on his drums, you know.
Yeah.
it's similar to Dave Brubeck's Take Five record. There's a drum solo towards the end where all of a sudden it builds up the same way and then kicks to the next section of the song. It's very similar to that, you know, other than one's a rock song and one's a jazz song, but compare those two sometime. It'd be fun to pick that out.
Totally.
So, and then the Who Sellout is a riot. That's the one with, influenced by pirate radio in the 60s in Great Britain, where
mm-hmm.
they'd go out on ships and play records. And I think they'd have to pay fees or something. But there was still, I think there were still commercials on them. And there's all these, the Who's Sellout album has all those commercials in between. But I'm still not sure if they made them up for the record, they use actual commercials. But they're structured like little mini operas. Instead of your standard radio commercials, they all connect together, kind of like Quadrophenia, where it all just builds up to the next song. The best example is end of side one, the Pussycat, and you know where it's at, that's everything. The inside, big baby, speakeasy, won't get pulled together, wrote the sound strings, boom, and then won't get, I Can See for Miles kicks in. I did not do that justice. So you need
it's hard to replicate this.
Yeah, you need to pick that up, and it's worth the price of admission. Just that last section leading to I Can See for Miles on that record, and on side two, they kind of get away from the commercial concept, but
that's what it is.
Yeah, I think there's been reissues where they add more commercials again too. So that's a really fun record. And very representative of 60s rock and roll on the radio.
Nice.
And the first album, My Generation, is groundbreaking. Steve Van Zandt, Springsteen's, do you follow him on Twitter by any chance, Steve Van Zandt?
Not necessarily.
Because he's always on Twitter, but he has said that's their best album. So.
Nice.
And he likes the Beatles' Help album too, which is an odd choice, but I can kind of see where he's coming from too. Like, what your favorite Beatles album? You know, what day of the week is it? You know,
right.
Anyway, so we get back down to Stevie Wonder, who I'm trying to think. I've seen, look at the top 10 list real quick. I've seen Paul McCartney for the Beatles. I've seen Bob Dylan several times. Obviously, I haven't seen Jimi Hendrix. Saw Van Morrison once. I've seen Graham Parker. Obviously, couldn't see Otis Redding. I've seen the Stones, Springsteen, and at least three members of the Who. And I also saw Stevie Wonder in Saginaw, his hometown, once. So that was
sweet.
It's pretty cool that I've been able to see most of these artists live at least once. So a great way to start with Stevie Wonder. I say this, but I don't know if it's available anymore. I bought it years ago, and it's still in decent shape. It's a three-record set called Looking Back.
Mm-hmm.
It's when Motown was putting out these two or three-record sets of greatest hits.
Right.
And they usually were, you know, named after the artist, but they put a title on Stevie Wonder's, called it Looking Back. I think the other ones are like Best of Temptations or something like that. Oh, no, they call them Anthology. That's right. Nah. Temptations Anthology, Four Taps Anthology. But they made an exception for Stevie Wonder, called it Looking Back, but it's an anthology. And it's everything up to early 70s. And if you want to just get one Stevie Wonder album, it's a great one to get to represent his 60s stuff anyway. Right. You know, from Fingertips Part 2 all the way through to early 70s when he really started to be his own artist instead of the Motown sound.
Good.
Then there's I think it's a trilogy, Inner Visions, Talking Book, and Songs in the Key of Life are just, he was kind of, in a way, after the Beatles broke up, he kind of took over that mantle for a while. Other people said Elton John did, but I don't really agree with that. I like Elton John, but not to that extent. I think Stevie Wonder was more creative, especially Songs on the Key of Life. Some of it's got a real Abbey Road feel.
Right.
And the way the songs connect one to another, like side two of Abbey Road. Let me just a second here. Inner Visions. I remember Paul Simon, one year at the Grammys, he thanked Stevie Wonder for not putting on a record this year because
he wanted to win.
Yeah, he was always getting Grammys, and deservedly so. Oh, Inner Visions, good grief. It's got Too High, Living for the City, which is great, except for that little, have you ever heard this song? With that little dramatic thing where somebody gets busted in New York City.
I don't think so. It definitely didn't get radio play.
That little sketch in the middle, a little mini thing, that kind of hasn't aged well. But the song itself is great.
Stevie Wonder. Oh, yes, where he's getting beat up by the cops. Yeah.
Yeah, New York, just like I pictured it. Remember? Yeah. And then... Yeah, and then hey, can you do me a favor? And then the cops.
Sign of the times, baby.
Yep. Yep. But it's a little overdramatic, but the point is well made. You're right. But Steve Wonder is also a great ballad singer. All in Love is Fair is a beautiful song on there. Don't You Worry About a Thing. Dun, 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 dun. Golden Lady is a really cool song. And then Talking Book.
You know, you're awesome when you make an appearance in Die Hard. Skeleton song.
Plays
during the limo scene.
Oh, what song is it? Are they playing?
Skeletons, like 70s.
Oh, from Stevie Wonder?
Mm hmm. It's
pretty. Oh, okay, yeah, that's a later song. Okay. Okay, yeah. I know which one you're talking about now. Took me a second. I thought you were talking about a Ricky Lee Jones song, because she's got one called that, which is really back to what we were talking about earlier about the cops, you know, shooting somebody, you know.
Yep.
Stones have a song like that too called Heartbreaker.
Of course. Yeah.
Yeah, there's a trilogy, the Skeletons and then American Skin by Bruce Springsteen. those are like three songs you could play back to back, but all cover the same topic. All very well. Talking Book, You Are the Sunshine of My Life. Blame It on the Sun. Superstition. Yeah. He had a real good run there for a while. There's certain artists like the Rolling Stones and Bruce, and where they just have three or four records in a row and just knock it out of the park every time. And early 70s Stevie Wonder is like that. So, boy, Songs in the Key of Life is probably my favorite. And so, I think Songs in the Key of Life is the first record had bonus tracks, because when it came out in, on vinyl, it was a two record set, but then it had a 45 with four more songs, two on each side.
Wow.
I think he kind of introduced the concept of bonus tracks, because, you know, now, especially with CDs, I always do that now when they reissue stuff. Oh, bonus tracks.
So often.
Yeah. But I think that may be the first record to do that.
Hmm.
Anyway, I'm exhausted now. So anyway, I've just scratched the surface on these artists. The best thing to do is just, you know, listen to them. And there's so many ways to listen to music now. Mm-hmm. Punch them up on Alexa or whatever you need to do.
Whatever you got to do. And which do you recommend out of all of these? I mean, I get that they're all pretty awesome, but like just sitting everyone down, like, obviously, you got to get a pretty good stereo going and everything. But
oh, which record out of all of them?
Yeah, out of each of them, would you say? Like, if you had to go with one from each one.
Oh, okay. Beatles, I'd go the Beatles. I refuse to call it the other name. Everybody calls it, look, the cover's white. Let's call it the White Album. The actual title is the Beatles, the title's so great because it's really the Beatles solo backed up by the other Beatles. It really broke ground. All their other albums are Beatles albums, really, but that one is just, I said that before, it sounds like it was recorded 3 weeks ago. It's still so fresh. All their albums are great, but they all sound okay. That was the 60s, you know, but that one, it influenced 70s rock. It still sounds like something. I don't know if it's the recording quality or the quality of the songs, but it just escapes their catalog. And I play it, everything on it, all the way through every time. I will not skip Revolution 9. You need that, because then you get Good Night, Ringo's, it makes it haunting, you know.
Yep.
So Bob Dylan, I would go with Highway 61 Revisited, because I still can't believe that came out in 1965. It's they were making this kind of music in 1965, you know. The Monkees.
Yeah. No one expected it. How could
they? Yeah. It just transcends the form. Hendrix, I tend to like double albums, so I got to go Electric Ladyland, because side three, the psychedelia on there outdoes the Beatles psychedelia, I think. Van Morrison, Astral Weeks. Other than the fact his voice is a little rough, it's transcendent. It's hard to describe this. Again, you got to play these albums, you know.
Right.
Graham Parker, Squeezing Out Sparks. That's all you need. Yeah. It just, back to front, it just cooks. Otis Redding, I'd go Live in Europe, just because it's a definitive live album. Maybe it's Springsteen live albums. If you see him in concert and then get a live album, it doesn't do it justice, but with the Otis Redding Live in Europe, you get, okay, this is what it was like, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Every time I hear Bruce live album, even the live videos, it's like, yeah, but I've seen him do this. The problem, That's because I've seen him 60 times and I know what he's capable of, you know.
I just kept rewatching the same music concert that was from like 2001.
the one that was on HBO?
Yeah.
That's 2000, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a phenomenal one. What am I saying? They're all great. It's pretty sure that's what all great live albums are. The one he just put out last December, the No Nukes show, is amazing. You got to get the Blu-ray of that. I was actually on East Street Radio telling them that I drove from Grand Rapids to New York City in 1980 just to see the movie because it wasn't showing in town and I couldn't wait.
Are you for real?
Man. I really did. And Dave Marsh goes, I don't blame you.
Shit.
Well, plus I was 20. I wanted to get out, you know, get out and see the world a little bit. Okay, I read, oh, it's shown in New York City. Of course, it showed in Grand Rapids a couple months later. But I told you, I was a little nutty about Springsteen after seeing him first time. So I've since calmed down a little bit. So anyway, we were at Squeezing Out Spider, Otis Ray Levin, Rolling Stones, Exile on Main Street, but if you want a shorter record, Sticky Fingers is just as good. Springsteen, I'd go still to this day, Born to Run. Even though, yeah, he hasn't put a bad record out, you know. the quiet, folky ones, I go, I don't know if I want. Then I start playing it, I got to hear the end of this.
This is that good, but it's taking a bit.
What's that?
This is that good, but it takes a bit to just warm up at first.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I thought you were having technical problems. Sorry.
No. I hope not. I haven't beat
that. This is not good, but it's tanking a bit. Okay. Taking a bit. I gotcha. Okay. Ghost of Tom Joad is a quiet record you got to listen to late at night, but it's very cinematic. Some of those stories are amazing on there, and it's very... It's about people. You know, most of his records are about people, about being human. You know, and that's what's going on there. Then the Who, Quadrophenia, because like I've said, it's a double and it flows better than any record I've ever heard. And Stevie Wonder, Songs in the Key of Life. That's a cliche, but it's a cliche because it's great. So, all right.
By all means, and where can we find you on the web?
I'm sorry?
Where can we find you on the web?
Oh, my music page? Or, oh, Facebook or?
Wherever you would prefer to promote.
Yeah, I've got a music page on Facebook called Music Past and Present, and there's only about 115 people on it, but I can add you.
I'm in the group.
Yeah, I added you. I've kind of gotten away from posting in there a lot, but right now, this last year or two, I've been going through 20 artists. Yeah, I've been going through 20 artists, 10 of which I just mentioned, and the other 10 are artists I wanted to listen to more. I'm going through their whole catalog and then posting about it, or just putting a picture of them up there. But there's fun stuff on there.
We'll return after these messages.
The Jacked Up Review Show podcast is honored to be part of the Blind Knowledge Podcast Network. Join anytime, talk the talk, and enjoy yourselves. There's something enlightening for everyone with this crowd of cool cats. Check them out.
Hey, it's Brent Pope, the host of Breakfast with Brent Pope. You've seen me on some of your favorite TV shows saying things like, "Give it up, Jimmy. You got to sink this putt to win." On Breakfast with Brent Pope, I sit down with guests from the entertainment world and we do it all over breakfast. Or should I say Breakfast? Every week on Breakfast, you get inside Hollywood info and tips, great breakfast recs and booty debates. Most of all, you get the most delightful 30 minutes of your week. So dig in. It's Breakfast time. Listen at Breakfast.com, Apple Podcasts, or wherever fine podcasts are found.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win Show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a Jacked Up.